We have Clive Manzese, political economy analyst and researcher, joining us from London. And we also have economist and author Steve Keen, also joining us from the British capital.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Menzies. New research by a cross-party group has found that 1 in 50 Londoners are now homeless as living costs and rent soar. Why has housing become so unaffordable in the UK?
1 in 50 sounds rather high. That's 2% of the population, which does sound high. But leaving that aside, the whole housing premise is based on money. And money is basically driving the inflation. And people are finding it harder and harder to live. And this is not only reflected in homelessness. Even people who are working for a wage are being stretched further and further. I was talking to our postman today, and he's being asked to do more and more, almost making his task impossible. And you talk to health workers, you talk to all sorts of workers across all industries, and they're all being asked to do more with less. And this is all down to what was utterly predictable when they started the bank bailouts in 2008 and all the subsequent quantitative easing, and then the amount of money that's been generated in furlough payments, track and trace programs, sending money to Ukraine and elsewhere. Basically, the system is now in full plunder mode, and people are feeling the worst effects of it. But the homelessness is much more complex than just money, in the sense that there is a whole agenda that is driven by debt in order to create development, which may or may not be ultimately occupied. Both there's a lot of conversion of offices into homes, turning effectively creating sort of rabbit hutch-like dwellings within urban environments. So I find the statistics produced by council somewhat suspect, but I think there's probably a much deeper story than just 1 in 50 are homeless.
Steve Keen, let's bring you in on the discussion. What is causing this crisis? And also, do you think that the UK is heading for a housing market crash?
Well, every time it heads for a crash, the government tries to reinflate the market again, and this is really where a lot of the problem comes from. To give a comparison, I actually live in Amsterdam and spend some time in London as well. And the contrast between the two cities is dramatic in every possible sense, but most dramatically in terms of how many homeless people you confront. You cannot walk along a major street in London without striking someone who's homeless or the remnants of their clothing, whatever else, within 50 metres, every 50 metres at least. In Amsterdam, you can go 5 kilometres and not see somebody who is homeless. Why? Because the way the Dutch cope with the homelessness issue was to, surprise, surprise, build homes and house the homeless in quite reasonable accommodation, not in the heart of the city, but not particularly far away either. And that was quite effective. So the homelessness is, I think, not quite a uniquely a British phenomenon, but it shows just how badly the British model in general is failing. And that's been a model which has been based on a housing bubble and using London as a way of laundering the world's wealth. So there are so many incredibly expensive but also incredibly empty buildings in London. which could easily be occupied by the homeless, and it might be about time to take some direct action on that front, because clearly the government is doing nothing.
And staying with you, Mr. Keane, the squeeze on renters, it's just one symptom of Britain's wider housing crisis. At its heart is a problem of insufficient supply, as you just mentioned, and, of course, spiraling affordability. How badly are interest rates impacting renters right now?
Well, they're not directly affecting renters, because renters obviously don't have mortgages. But the squeeze on the availability of rental properties, combined with the pressure on landlords from rising mortgage rates, means they're putting up rental costs, which, of course, is causing inflation, which is the reason they're being putting up rates is to reduce inflation, but they're actually creating it by making it more expensive for people holding mortgages. And it quite possibly could cause a crash, because what actually causes rising house prices is rising levels of new mortgage debt. And if you're putting up rates as much as is happening right now, that market for borrowing money to build housing and the belief you're going to get a capital gains return out of it could evaporate, and that could bring the market unstuck. That's more likely to bring interest rates down than the failure so far of rising interest rates to cause falling inflation.
Clive Menzies, as housing insecurity seems to be becoming more mainstream now, what are the solutions at hand? The report by the Group London Councils warned that the capital's housing crisis is becoming unmanageable and called for emergency action from the government to help low-income families. Are there any signs of emergency action from the government?
I gravely doubt it, because this whole economy is based on wealth transference rather than wealth creation. Steve referred to expensive empty properties, of which there are many. I suppose one could consider forcing those to be open to the homeless and others, but it would mean controlled rents and all of those sorts of things, which are horrendously difficult to implement. So I think what we're looking at is merely a symptom of something much bigger, that our structure is broken. It is no longer fit for purpose. These cycles, economic cycles, have just repeat and repeat and repeat in history. And what happens every time, there is more wealth, significantly more wealth transference, not in terms of the money, that's the mechanism, but actually real wealth creation resources are transferred from the majority to the minority. And this is down to our money system, which is not only the single point of failure, but it fails the majority of people within a given economy. We now have the capability to go beyond money. Money was created because it was difficult to deal with strangers because you knew nothing about them. But now we have the technological ability and the building blocks to build a totally different model where actually you don't need money, and we're not talking about exchange. I mean, the problem with it is just an idea that has been created and psyche, but actually enough money. It's a bit like saying you haven't got enough inches to build a house, because money is merely a measurement of the allocation of resources, and it is grossly inefficient because it benefits in the main a very small minority, whilst the rest of the majority scrabble to climb the ladder of wealth in order to achieve some sort of decent life, and clearly more and more are failing to do that. So we need a total economic rethink rather than band-aid plastering over homelessness crisis, joblessness, or whatever it may be. The fundamental foundations of the economy are broken, and we need to think differently.
Steve Keane, anti-poverty campaigners have been warning of a catastrophe. The Bank of England, as we know, it raised interest rates by the biggest margins in nearly three decades. It did so to ride out inflation mainly caused by soaring energy and food prices, but to no avail. What are the solutions, in your opinion, both in the short term and in the long run?
Well, one of them is to reverse the obsession that the British parliamentary system has with austerity. What austerity actually does is say government should not use its capacity to create money. That should all be done by the private sector. That's not what the Austerians think they're doing, but that's the effect. The outcome of that, of course, is you have less money creation and less growth coming out of the economy, while the politicians are telling the economy to grow faster with less, which is a bit like a slogan from the bad days of Mao's Communist Party in China. It's failed, and it's about time they realise the government should be running deficits to help create the money that the private sector can spend with, and it could spend that, create that money addressing the homelessness crisis that austerity itself has created. But it does, as I agree, involve a complete change in the orientation of politics and the monetary system in the UK. And there's absolutely no sign of that being thought of by either side of politics in the UK. So I think we're going to see that 2% number rise.
Clive Menzies, let's talk about the elephant in the room. How much of this economic woes that the UK is facing is due to the consequences of the Ukraine war? Many blame the UK's economic woes primarily on the situation in Ukraine. Would you agree with them?
I think Ukraine is yet a vehicle for plunder that has created huge amounts of money that have been shipped out in arms, weapons aid, etc. And yes, that is a factor. But arguably, this started much sooner. If you go back to March 2020, when the whole COVID psyop started, they were dishing out money, they were creating and dishing out money in terms of FOLO payments, business bank loans, track and trace programs worth billions that came to nothing. I mean, to say that there is not money being created is inaccurate. There's been huge amounts of money being created, but I would agree with Steve, it's not being created for anything productive or to satisfy the needs of the majority. It's being created because we're now in full plunder mode. This economic structure is beginning to disintegrate, and the more it disintegrates, the more rapacious the extortion of money and resources and energy from workers, consumers, and the vast majority of the people. And nobody really benefits from this because even those who are materially wealthy are inconvenienced by a lot of what's going on. So clearly it is a system that satisfies nobody, or at least very, very, very few.
Steve Keen, we can't look at Britain's economic situation now without mentioning the B word, Brexit, and its disruptions in trade. Is the UK now feeling the ripple effects of leaving the Union, and is there still more to come from that divorce?
Well, I mean, everything the Tories have touched has turned to lead, and Brexit was an obvious case of that. The reason they ran the referendum was that Cameron believed the referendum would lose, and therefore he'd get rid of the Brexit part of his party. Instead, he lost his prime ministership, and then we've been through three since then. So it's incompetence all round. But the overall obsession goes right back to Maggie Thatcher. The belief the government should do effectively nothing and leave it all to the private sector, while at the same time liberating the financial sector to create bubbles rather than real enterprise. So it's not just the last 2 years, it's the last 50 years or 40 years of British politics and the dominance by the belief the government should not spend money or should not create it in the first place. But reversing, even though the performance has clearly been a disaster, right since 1973, which led to the collapse of the manufacturing sector in the UK, but even since the crisis, where Britain has grown more slowly than most of its comparable trading partners, by following a policy of austerity. So, the only thing which could make the politicians change their minds on this, if some of them became homeless, but that's not going to happen.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
And let's address the same question to Clive Menzies. Are we still, is the UK basically right now still feeling the ripple effects of leaving the EU?
Well, I don't think we left the EU. In many respects, we're in lockstep militarily, financially, legally. The things that Brexit has actually caused people inconvenience are the things that are relatively minor, but they're the biggest irritations. But Brexit, my view of Brexit, it was a bit like Donald Trump. It basically polarized opinion. There was a danger that before 2015, people were beginning to catch on that the structure was inherently at fault, and they were examining or exploring possibilities to do something different. Both the election of Donald Trump and Brexit succeeded in polarizing, if you like, the 99%, almost 50-50. So people have been arguing over a non-issue with Brexit. There is military unification going on. We tend to comply with most of what Europe dictates. Yes, at the margin, there are cosmetic differences that may be buoyed up or played up in the press, but we haven't left Europe. On the contrary, more and more power is being drawn to the center, both in terms of the UN, the World Health Organization, all of these large, unelectable, unaccountable bodies like the EU, and they're now also influencing effectively city-states directly. So you have London with its mayor being, and other British cities being managed almost independently of government. So it's basically a massive power grab through the structure that is going on, but it's going to fail.
Steve Keane, throughout all the difficulties that Britons are facing, from the cost of living crisis to the stagflation and et cetera, the Labour Party has been criticizing the Tories, saying this is the result of 12 years of mismanagement of their government. Do you believe the Tory leadership is to blame, at least for failing to prepare for these tough days?
Oh, absolutely. The Tories set it up by believing the whole myth of saving for a rainy day, by the government running the budget surpluses. What those surpluses actually do is take money out of the private sector, and the private sector then goes to the private banks to borrow money instead, and we get caught up in speculative bubbles. So by supposedly saving for a rainy day, what they've done is encourage a bubble economy when the bubble was already pretty much over, because the bubble relies upon rising levels of private debt, and we reached peak private debt in the UK back in 2009. So they're floundering. They get away with their decisions because of the five-year electoral term in the UK. Everybody wants them out, possibly including half the Tory party itself. But they're not going to go until the next election. And then in the meantime, the Labour Party is trying to look like Tory light. So there's no real promise of any change coming from the Labour Party as well. England really is adrift.
Clive Menzies, is the UK suffering from a faltering leadership with the Tories at its helm?
Well, as I've said many times, I don't think it makes much difference. If you look at the trajectory of where we've come from, a lot of this started under Tony Blair with public-private partnerships, building schools for the future. All of these models were honed. The politicians aren't in power. They are basically backed, bankrolled, and put in place because they will do as they're told. And if they don't do as they're told, they're marginalized or removed. Politics is theater. Most of what is going on the television is theater. What is really happening is that the system is progressively plundering, and it would make no difference. The NHS was effectively privatized when Tony Blair gave doctors contracts, which turned them from public sector employees who were in the business of trying to make people healthy, or so they thought, into executives of what are effectively sickness and disability industries, and arguably the pharmaceuticals have created more sickness than they've actually cured, so with side effects and what have you. So the there are many strands to this, but to put it down to party politics, you know, if we, as Steve says, you know, if you think voting is going to make any difference, then one is clearly mistaken.
And staying with you again, Mr. Menzies, the cost of living crisis has caused significant hardship throughout the country, triggered mass strikes across various public and private sectors. How do you see the chances of this public dissatisfaction with the quality of life snowballing into something bigger?
Well, it's no doubt we're probably in for a very bumpy ride. But as I've said before, as long as people adhere to the thought patterns and the practices of the past, then we're not going to get out of this. What is emerging at a grassroots level is people turning their back on the system in terms of the support it gives and looking for their own solutions, particularly in health, looking at information. Fewer and fewer people are taking information from mainstream media. People looking to develop means of creating or producing and distributing food. These are very small initiatives, but they're gathering momentum and they're building across the country and I would argue across the world, because whilst Britain may be in a worse state than most, none of the Western economies are immune from what's going on. Arguably, the US is similarly sort of afflicted.
Steve Keen, what are the chances of this public dissatisfaction with the quality of life snowballing into something bigger?
If the British were French, there'd be plenty of possibility, but the British are British, and they're likely to put up with it indefinitely. The capacity, you saw the level of protest by French workers against the attempt by Macron to raise the retirement age. There isn't that level of militancy in the UK. What there was, it was broken by Thatcher in the 70s and hasn't come back. So I think the British will just tolerate their continued decline.
All right, gentlemen, we're going to leave it there. Thank you for contributing to tonight's program. Mr. Clive Menzies, political economy analyst and researcher, joining us from London. And also thanks to economist and author Steve Keen, also joining us from the British capital. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the verses of chapter Nur, the 24th chapter of the Holy Quran, and different commentary points of these verses. Brothers and sisters, let's listen to the 23rd verse of the chapter.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم إن الذين يرمون المحصنات الغافلات المؤمنات لعنوا في الدنيا والآخرة ولهم عذاب عظيم
Indeed, those who falsely accused chaste, unaware, and believing women are cursed in this world and the hereafter, and they will have a great punishment.
We said that in the previous episode, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam considers this verse as a kind of evidence for the fact that unjust accusation of chaste women is one of the great sins. And this is so important because these chaste women are unaware of any kind of evil. They are believers. They are chaste, muhsanat. And the ones who accuse these kinds of people, they are cursed in this world and in hereafter. So, in the previous episode, we mentioned one possibility for the purpose of ghafilat. We mentioned that the word ghafilat could be used to mean that these chaste women, they were so heedless of sexual defilements that they did not know they existed in the world. Another possibility is that the purpose of ghafilat is the women who are not aware of the unjust accusations attributed to them, not just about sexual defilements. They are not aware of these accusations which are attributed to them. So they do not defend themselves because they do not know they are being targeted by these accusations. So this verse mentions a new matter about such accusations. Because the previous verses refer to the calumniators who could be recognized and then would be punished. But here, the rumor fabricators, the rumor mongers who have hidden themselves from punishment and religiously prescribed punishment are brought up. That's the importance of this verse. This is the new aspect of the meaning that this verse is revealed.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
حفظ الكتاب بصدره فبدا وضيئا كالنجوم تألقا وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Dear listeners, regarding the fact that this verse is placed right after the story of Ifk, an Ifk incident, and it seems that its revelation had some relation with this affair, but like many verses that are sent down for a special case and their content is general, this verse is also not limited to a certain case. It is strange that some commentators insist that the content of the verse is limited to the calumniation of the prophet's wives. These commentators believe, and they mainly equal this sin to paganism and consider the word lu'inu mentioned in the verse as reason for it. Of course, calumniation is a great sin. It is, and if it is especially about the wives of the prophet, it is greater. It is more cardinal. Yet it does not by itself bring paganism. So the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam did not treat those who were involved in that affair as the ones who are pagans, but as we explained in the commentary of the holy successive verse, the Prophet of Islam recommended the believers to be being more merciful toward them. And he ordered them not to be excessively violent toward the ones who were involved in that incident. And this means, this meaning mentioned by these commentators is not consistent with paganism. The word la'an originally means being away from Allah's bless. So, lu'inu fi dunya wal akhirah is applied to pagans and those who commit cardinal sins. So, in the verses of the Holy Quran, which are about the punishment of qadf and the ordinances of li'an, the word la'na has been applied two times about liars. In Islamic narrations, the word la'an and curse is frequently applied to those who commit great sins. The tradition also says, Allah has cursed 10 groups concerning wine is very famous, and we all have heard about it. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry, in your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry ends when faith begins.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
For the third time in 4 months, former United States President Donald Trump has been indicted. But this time, it's over his role in the controversial events in Washington on January 6, 2020. Trump pled not guilty to 4 counts of engaging in a criminal conspiracy to subvert the 2020 vote results and obstruction.
When you look at what's happening, this is a persecution of a political opponent. This was never supposed to happen in America. This is the persecution of the person that's leading by very, very substantial numbers in the Republican primary and leading Biden by a lot. So if you can't beat him, you persecute him or you prosecute him.
Most presidential vote polls show the race is too close to call. The ruling Democratic Party has put the United States in a historically unprecedented and potentially explosive situation. Polls show a nation evenly split on if Trump did anything illegal on January 6th and if it is time to move on from the events that day. Trump's approval rating is up 8 points among Republicans and Republican-leaning independents since the first indictment was handed down. Many Republicans have said that the long-delayed indictments for Trump, a sweetheart plea agreement for Biden's son, and the FBI's admitted collusion with social media companies to censor reporting which could have negatively impacted Biden in 2020 is proof of political bias in the nation's judicial system. Trump's defense is likely to include that he acted on the advice of well-regarded legal counsel, which may make it difficult to show criminal intent, and that he honestly believed the vote was not legal. A new poll shows that 70% of Republicans also believe that Biden's 2020 win was illegitimate. Multiple court cases against Trump, an increasingly likely impeachment trial in Congress for Joe Biden, ongoing corruption allegations against Joe's son Hunter Biden. The 2024 presidential campaign is shaping up to be even more divisive and full of mudslinging than in 2020. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Iran's Foreign Affairs Minister Hussein Amir Abdullahian is in Islamabad on a two-day official visit to hold bilateral talks with Pakistani officials on a host of regional issues. Upon his arrival, Bilawal Bhutto Zardari, the Pakistani counterpart, extended a warm welcome to him at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Islamabad on Thursday. Kicking off his visit, the Iranian foreign minister symbolically planted a pine tree of friendship at Pakistan's Foreign Office, signifying the state of cooperation and goodwill between the two nations. Subsequently, representatives from both sides finalized a 5-year strategic plan for commercial cooperation, signing a series of agreements and memorandum of understanding in diverse domains. During his visit, the Iranian foreign minister stressed the importance of bolstering bilateral cooperation in areas of economy, trade, and tourism. Furthermore, the Iranian FMA showed that Pakistan-Iran gas pipeline project will be completed at the earliest possible time, highlighting its potential to serve the national interests of both nations.
We do believe that the completion of the Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline project is definitely going to serve the national interests of these two countries. We study to see this gas pipeline to be completed, finalized and operationalized as soon as possible.
Urging support for the people of Afghanistan, he emphasized that the developments in the country would directly impact neighboring nations, with Iran and Pakistan being particularly affected.
We believe that the best solution to resolve problems in Afghanistan lies within the framework of regional initiatives. We believe that under any circumstances, it is our regional and humanitarian responsibility to support the people of Afghanistan.
Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari said Iran has played a pivotal role in providing electricity to the port city of Gwadar. Additionally, he said Islamabad and Tehran have successfully concluded a bilateral trade agreement for the period of 2023 to 2028, aiming to boost mutual trade between the two nations to a substantial $5 billion.
I am confident that the steps we are taking today will chart the course for a long-term, durable economic partnership between our two countries in the months and years ahead.
Bilawal said Pakistan and Iran have decided to repatriate all sentenced prisoners in accordance with the provisions laid out in existing agreements between the two nations.
The plight of prisoners and fishermen in our respective jails also came up during our talks. We have also decided to release all fishermen in custody in Pakistan and in Iran and to waive off any fines imposed by them to release their vessels.
Iran and Pakistan also decided to keep working together to fight rising anti-Muslim and Islamophobic sentiments.
The consecutive mutual visits by senior officials of Iran and Pakistan indicate that two neighboring countries are not only committed to bolstering their trade relations, but also are determined to strengthen their collaborative efforts in ensuring security and regional stability. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Leaving Lebanon's economy with an almost total economic meltdown, Riyad Salemi has stepped down as the governor of the central bank. The central bank's newly appointed acting governor, Wasim Mansouri, on Monday called on the government to implement a capital control law, a financial restructuring law, and a 2023 state budget within 6 months.
We were able to convince the government that the subsidies policy needs to stop, and as a result, management improved, and the economy relatively began to recover. However, the government's need for the U.S. dollar continues, since the only way to end the government's reliance on the central bank was to improve public finances. The problem is not monetary, and the solution is not with the central bank. The main issue is in the financial policies of the state, and there needs to be a clear decision to improve general management.
He stressed that the bank would impose restrictions on when to lend money to the government. Salemi was for years credited for economic recovery following Lebanon's civil war. Yet now he is being investigated by at least 7 countries, including Lebanon, for embezzlement and illicit enrichment. He denies the accusations. A former advisor to 3 central bank governors in Lebanon tells Press TV that Salemi was merely following the U.S. policies.
He was implementing the U.S. policies, and U.S. policies since the end of World War II stipulated that the countries of the Third World are prohibited from development. They only allowed Korea and Taiwan to prosper since they want to confront China and Russia, but they also supported Israel in this region and even prevented Egypt from becoming an industrial nation.
The problem, he believes, is a problem of mismanagement as well as in the structure of the policies, which bound the Lebanese lira to the U.S. dollar.
He pegged the price of the Lebanese lira to the U.S. dollar, saying that this would stabilize the lira, but this was a catastrophic mistake, which I had warned against. The U.S. dollar itself is not stable, so pegging the lira to the U.S. dollar won't make it stable. We needed to peg our currency to a basket of currencies based on imports to Lebanon. This impacted Lebanon's ability to compete in the global markets.
The current financial crisis began in 2019 when the value of the Lebanese lira plummeted and inflation soared in the Arab country. After 30 years in his post, Lebanon's former central bank governor is seen by many experts as being the main orchestrator of the financial and monetary policies, which led to an abrupt collapse. However, there are also speculations that he couldn't have done it without collaboration from the country's political elite. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The Arab woman who took on 2 far-right activists in a bid to save a Quran from desecration in Denmark has been identified. Iraqi-Danish citizen Quds al-Samarai risked her own life while en route to visit a friend on Monday, the 24th of July. The footage of the incident, which occurred outside Iraq's embassy, went viral on social media. The video clearly shows Quds grabbing the Quran before being wrestled to the ground by the 2 men. In one instance, one of the desecrators can be seen with his hands reaching for her neck. Police later arrested Quds on accusations she was stealing the Quran from the activists. Speaking to Press TV, Quds explained how the incident left her with minor injuries, but no regrets.
Here the police dragged me, and the man was shouting that I stole his property. I think he was scared because he knew hitting me was wrong, so he had to justify it by saying I stole. As soon as the police heard the word stealing, they immediately put me in handcuffs and gave him back the Quran. The police asked me what happened. I said I saw our Quran being burned, and I just wanted to put it out, and then I saw another Quran with shoes on it, and I wanted to take the shoe off. But I didn't realize that the shoe was nailed on the Quran. I told the police they hit me and strangled me, but they replied with, it's their freedom of speech. So I replied, okay. So it's also my freedom of speech to protect the Quran. I thought the police came to help me, but they turned out to twist the story by saying I was trying to steal.
Goods now faces a day in court, while her injuries have left her struggling to walk. Meanwhile, Muslims across the world remain in a state of anger as calls for serious action and retaliation to Europe's defense of far-right hate speech continues.
Despite Copenhagen officially condemning the incident, which occurred just where we stand outside Iraq's embassy a few days ago, that doesn't mean that they've outlawed the practice. And according to reports, several other similar incidents have already occurred since, with far-right activists again targeting the diplomatic buildings of Muslim-majority nations here in the Danish capital. However, this has come at a price. Denmark's defense of the so-called free speech of far-right activists to attack Islam's holy sanctities has led to both Denmark and Sweden's reputation to plummet across the Muslim world. Questions should surely be asked now whether it is indeed within the diplomatic interests of European countries to defend such a fringe extremist practice when, of course, there is so much at stake with economic backlashes from the Muslim world. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
For the first time, America is set to put on trial a former president in one of the most consequential criminal cases in the country's legal history. Ex-President Donald Trump has faced criminal charges for a third time in 4 months.
Today, an indictment was unsealed, charging Donald J. Trump with conspiring to defraud the United States, conspiring to disenfranchise voters, and conspiring and attempting to obstruct an official proceeding.
The indictment pertains to Trump's efforts to overturn his 2020 election defeat to incumbent President Joe Biden. It focuses on his actions in the two-month period between his loss to Biden and the infamous riot in Washington, D.C. During this period, Trump vehemently denied the election results, repeatedly asserting that the votes had been stolen.
All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing, and stolen by the fake news media. That's what they've done and what they're doing. We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved.
According to the indictment, Trump knowingly propagated false fraud claims and exerted pressure on state and federal officials, including Vice President Mike Pence, to manipulate the election results. When failed, Trump directed his supporters to stop certifying Biden's win. That turned into a violent attack on the U.S. Capitol, leading to 5 deaths, a move that is described as an attack on America's democracy.
The attack on our nation's capital on January 6, 2021, was an unprecedented assault on the seat of American democracy.
Trump vehemently dismisses the case as ridiculous and maintains his innocence, refuting any allegations of wrongdoing. He even goes further to accuse the prosecutors of being politically motivated, claiming they are acting on behalf of Biden to meddle in the forthcoming presidential elections in which Trump and Biden could face off again. The two are currently tied in polls. The Trump campaign has also asserted that the Tuesday indictment amounts to election interference. Nonetheless, this is not the only obstacle standing in the way of Trump's return to presidency. The Republican politician has already been charged in 2 other cases, mishandling classified files and falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment to an adult film actress, the charges that have significantly hit the former president's reputation among many Americans.
I hope he goes to prison for a long time. I think he deserves to go to prison for all the crimes he committed.
Donald Trump is now due to appear in a Washington, D.C. court on Thursday. He faces 78 criminal counts overall. These charges mean the ex-president will have 3 criminal trials to attend in the next 12 to 18 months, complicating his second run for the White House.
A private workshop in Kabul, where over 50 women are working and being trained, has provided a place for women to learn making different handicrafts. These women are producing stunning artifacts, despite the problems they stumble upon.
We produce traditional clothing such as leather purses and shoes, hats, carpets and traditional dresses. We used to earn a living previously, but now our sales have decreased and most families face economic problems as a result.
Fereshta Hashemi, the woman who launched this place, says more and more women are showing interest in private workshops because restrictions imposed by the Taliban has deprived them from social activities.
Previously, the schools and universities were open to women, but now, as a result of the restrictions on women, girls cannot go to school and female teachers have lost their job, which is why they show interest in learning a profession so they could work in the future and earn a living.
Lida, one of the trainees in this workshop, was a teacher when the Taliban banned women from education and women teachers lost their jobs. She says maybe in the future this profession helps her earn a living.
Previously, I was a teacher and I lost my job. I wanted to learn a profession, so I came here. I am learning leather crafting now and hope to run my workshop someday to earn a living.
When the Taliban took control of the country in 2021, they banned women from education and gradually from most of the jobs in the country. Even most female-dominated professions like women's hairdressing salons were closed a week ago. Women in Afghanistan are taking refuge in small businesses not only to provide for their families, but also to get relieved from the mental pressure of being restricted from education and the other jobs they used to do. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
From Vermont to Texas, desperately needed coronavirus-era social programs are ending in the United States. On August 1st, many areas ended their moratoriums on debt to landlords, meaning nearly a million children are now at risk of eviction in the city of Los Angeles alone. Families have the highest risk of losing their home, while half of those saying they expect to be evicted are Black or Latino. Evictions in the United States have recently soared to reach double what they were before the pandemic.
Lost our jobs because of the pandemic, lost everything we had because of the pandemic. We found a place to live with a buddy in Cheyenne, Wyoming, but he died, and that was in March. And so we decided to come out here because we thought there would be more opportunities. We're just hoping to get jobs and get into a place to live, and get a car and function. And that, so far, we've been struck out. As you can see, we're packing our bags. We're going back to Colorado.
America's decentralized model of federalism makes a nationwide approach to the evictions wave impossible. Public camping is illegal in many places, like Texas, which makes it harder for charity workers to find and help the homeless.
I had a stroke, and I was bleeding on the brain, and, you know, I had to go to rehab a lot to learn how to walk and talk again and all that. I've only been homeless like a year and a half. I went to Cornerstone Shelter, Sarah Circle Shelter, and now I'm in a ton. But I got a caseworker, I went to church, and the Cornerstone supervisor told me I popped up on a her computer and I got, you know, she's got housing for me.
Other vital social services are also being withdrawn. Millions of Americans, including children and new mothers, just lost their medical coverage for the first time in 3 years after Washington refused to extend the pandemic-era program. College tuition debt represents an incredible 7% of U.S. GDP. In October, 41 million Americans will have to start repaying an average of $400 per month. And many say this alone could push the country into a recession. A lack of affordable housing is something that any committed government can easily fix. By writing laws which favor tenants instead of rich landlords, by putting more tax revenue into building more public housing, and by creating more shelters for those with emergency needs. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
In the Limelight.
Campaigners have accused banks in the UK of discriminating against British Muslims by disproportionately denying them banking services and closing their accounts without adequate transparency and recourse. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, British Muslims have been disproportionately denied banking services and had their bank accounts closed without adequate transparency and recourse, campaigners have said. The Muslim Council of Britain, which serves as the largest representative body for UK Muslims, sent letters to Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, Chancellor Jeremy Hunt and opposition party leaders recently demanding the protection of universal banking rights. In the letters, the MCB Secretary General Zara Mohammed said successive governments had ignored the issue of banks withdrawing services from British Muslims and the practice had persisted without adequate transparency and recourse for those affected. Mohammed added, "We urge for an impartial review that not only addresses the mechanisms behind bank accounts closures, but also examines why British Muslims are disproportionately affected by this issue." The MCB's intervention comes after figures from Britain's Financial Conduct Authority named Muslims as the only faith group likely to be unbanked in Britain. The letters also come after former UK Independence Party leader Nigel Farage had his bank accounts closed by Coutts, a prestigious private bank for the wealthy because of his political views. The fallout led to chief executives at NatWest, Coutts' parent company, resigning and the commencement of an independent review into the targeting of Farage. In recent weeks, Muslim faith-based charities and pro-Palestine solidarity groups have highlighted that they have been subject to bank closures for years as a result of their political views without a major backlash from politicians or the press. While Farage received a 40-page report regarding the closure of his Quds account, many Muslim charities told Middle East Eye they had not received the same explanation. Fadi Itani, the CEO of the UK-based Muslim Charities Forum, says that charities have been facing bank closures for over two decades and are often over-policed by banks and their policies. He told MEE this typically happens with organizations working in more sensitive regions where there is a higher security risk, but we found this to be extended to a much wider definition, creating an unfair burden for charitable organizations to work with. In 2015, the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, the UK's most prominent pro-Palestinian organization, had its bank account with the cooperative bank closed, with no further explanation cited other than the bank's risk appetite. MEE reached out to the UK Treasury for comment but did not receive a response by the time of publication. Also, according to Arab News, anti-Muslim hate cases in the UK have more than doubled in 10 years, according to a new study by Tel Mama, which supports the victims of Islamophobia, The Independent reported recently. The organization, which also monitors anti-Muslim sentiment across the UK, said reported Islamophobic incidents had grown annually from 584